Have you ever thought about the future? Not tomorrow or next year, but what life might look 60 years from now? It's actually really hard, and we know that because 60 years ago, we asked people to try.
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers.
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
So will our predictions be just as wrong? I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a special series about why it's so hard to predict the future. It's available now on ABC Listen.
What's your reaction to your brother's arrest, sir? Any reaction to your brother's arrest, sir?
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the extraordinary news of the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. You'll have already heard extensive coverage of this basically everywhere you turn, but on today's show, you're going to hear from the journalist who once interviewed him.
Convicted. Yes. Did you see him or speak to him again?
No, that was that. Funny enough, 2010 was it. That was it.
He's been a punchline, really, since that Newsnight interview 5 years ago.
So on today's Wrap, former BBC Newsnight presenter Emily Maitlis shares her reaction to news of Andrew's arrest.
Honestly, I am stunned. This doesn't happen in our country. It is virtually unheard of.
But that's not all happening today.
There's plenty of attention on disgraced princes, and there is almost no attention on what's happening in Sudan.
We'll also get the latest on Sudan, as the UN says atrocities there bear the hallmarks of genocide. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap.
You're watching BBC News. I'm Lauren Taylor. We start with breaking news about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. The BBC understands that he has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office.
Deepest concern from the King. Police arrived at the Sandringham estate this morning and are currently searching addresses in Berkshire and Norfolk.
Charles R's statement saying that the law must take its course. All laws in this country are executed in his name, and now he finds himself in the position of having officers acting on his behalf, arresting his own brother.
Well, that is how Britons woke up to the news of the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. You would have heard extensive coverage of this right across the news, but let me just give you a quick timeline of how this has played out today. At 8 a.m. local time, on the morning of Andrew's 66th birthday, police arrived at the Sandringham estate to arrest him on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Police raided his property and his former home at Windsor. He was detained for 10 hours and this morning released under investigation. Now, he's not been charged and he's always denied any wrongdoing in relation to Jeffrey Epstein, but he has not been exonerated. His brother, King Charles, wasn't notified about the arrest in advance, and as he was arriving at London's Fashion Week, he was peppered with questions by reporters.
What's your reaction to your brother's arrest, sir? Sir, what's your reaction to your brother's arrest?
The King did release a statement saying that the law must take its course. I'm going to bring you more of the reaction to this story from here and around the world, but one voice you want to hear from first is Emily Maitlis. Her BBC Newsnight interview in 2019 with the then Prince Andrew was widely regarded as a car crash for the Prince, one of the moments that began his unravelling. 6 years on, and just hours after this news broke, Emily Maitlis dialed in to speak to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast.
What's your reaction to this arrest of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor?
Honestly, I am stunned. To say that this is a crisis moment, I think, doesn't begin to cover it. Prince Andrew, ex-Prince Andrew, remains eighth in line to the throne. He still lives on a royal estate. So whichever way you spin this, this does go back to the most senior institution in the entire country.
When you conducted your interview with the then Prince Andrew, could you ever have imagined that we would be at this point now?
I think it's really curious that the response has been, you know, just from people that I've talked to today, some people have been saying, well, why did it take 6 years to get to this point? Obviously, we have to say that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor denies all wrongdoing. There have been no charges. There are no convictions. But he is in a position where the course of the law is being allowed to take its path. And I think for a lot of people in this country, they felt, well, I don't understand why that's taken 6 years. And for other people, it's all seemed to happen incredibly quickly, because this was not fundamentally about allegations of sexual abuse. This was not about allegations of trafficking. None of the stuff that Virginia Giuffre, Epstein's late victim, survivor, who took her own life tragically last April. This was nothing to do with any of those allegations. It was all to do with something that feels much more distant in a way. It's to do with misconduct in public office. In other words, it's an alleged sort of white-collar crime about the handling of classified confidential information on email. And so we have to sort of separate out the two things, which are people have been looking in one direction and saying, well, I don't understand why this investigation hasn't taken, you know, Prince Andrew, ex-Prince Andrew to Congress, or hasn't taken him further towards a police investigation. But what has happened now has happened almost entirely as a result of what we're seeing from the Epstein files.
What does this mean for the royal family now, particularly in the way that it communicates with the public? There seems to be an element of business as usual in the King's engagements today, but also the release of a public statement.
I thought that statement was absolutely critical, because in it, the King makes no mention of his younger brother. He doesn't use the word brother. He says the law must take its course. And we also learned today that the palace was not tipped off about the arrest before it happened around 8 o'clock this morning. He starts with this curious phrase, doesn't he? He says, I learnt of the news with deepest concern. And it's not entirely clear who that concern is for. Does he mean for his brother? Does he mean for Epstein victims? Does he mean for anyone involved in the sort of wider circle of the family? I don't actually know. But I think the fact that he's saying the law must take its course is really critical. And your question about the relationship now between the press and the monarchy is so interesting, because last week we saw Prince William in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. He was on a walkabout, and I suddenly saw this headline, you know, on Sky News that said, oh, Prince William heckled about, you know, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And actually, it wasn't a heckle. It was a question from a journalist. And I think that tells you so much, because up till this point, there has been this kind of invisible deal, hasn't there, between the way that we as journalists report on the royal family, as if it's a completely different entity, as if it has sort of nothing to do with our normal day jobs. And so the fact that we thought anyone shouting out a question about, you know, Andrew, Prince Andrew, to the heir to the throne was somehow quite scandalous, I think tells you the position that we've been in for so long. And I think that has changed now. And really, what the King is weighing up, I guess, I mean, I'm imagining, is whether the public associate him, his monarchy, with Andrew, his brother, or whether we can, in our minds, divorce it, whether the King has done enough to separate out whatever his brother has or hasn't done with the rest of the monarchy. And I would say that there is very little question in my mind that when King Charles removed his brother's title last October, when he took away his Windsor residence, the Royal Lodge, he was essentially saying to the forces of justice in this country, I don't want to tie your hands. He's my brother, but he is no longer untouchable. In other words, let justice do its course.
What is the political challenge for the Prime Minister now?
Well, what has been interesting has been the intervention of not the current Prime Minister, but a former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, who has been incredibly active, actually, in calling for police investigations. And even now, today, he's talking about the importance of releasing the flight logs. This is something that two different police forces are looking into now, flight logs around Luton Airport and around Stansted Airport, over questions of sexual trafficking, in other words, the human trafficking of Epstein's victims. And I think it's sending out an important message, actually, from Gordon Brown, which is, yes, today we're talking about misconduct. We're talking about allegations of confidential information shared, you know, when Prince Andrew was a trade envoy. In other words, as I said, sort of white-collar crime. But the fact that Gordon Brown is saying, let's not take our eye off the ball, it is possible that these investigations can operate at the same time. You know, there are, I think, 8 or 9 different police forces. It is an unprecedented number, all looking into one suspect at the same time.
How do you reflect on the self-awareness of Andrew? That was one of the main themes that emerged from the 2019 interview. How have you observed what appeared to be his understanding of the public perception of him?
I guess what Andrew sort of proved in that particular interview was that he wasn't that conscious of how he was coming across to sort of normal people, to sort of, you know, everyday people. But then, you know, I have to flip that round and say he'd never done an interview like that before. You know, that is part of being a royal, that they are shielded and protected and gilded and locked away. They don't really face the press on questions that are intensely personal and intensely potentially reputationally damaging. And he did. And he chose to do that. He chose to give us an hour to try and sort of emerge from that in a better state. And we're sort of trying to get to grips with that today.
And that is the former BBC journalist, Emily Maitlis, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Well, there's been significant reaction to this news, including from the survivors and relatives of survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. Now, it's worth clarifying that Andrew has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office, not sexual offences. But the brother and sister-in-law of Virginia Giuffre have spoken. The late Giuffre previously alleged Andrew had sex with her as a teenager. It's an allegation the former prince has always denied. Here's her brother, Sky Roberts.
I think we're very hopeful that this is the start of the domino effect. This is where the house of cards starts falling. And, you know, kudos to the UK for taking the first step, for saying, you know what, we are going to arrest somebody who is held to one of the highest esteems out there, somebody who was a former prince. I mean, this hasn't been done before. And so to know what we should expect, it's really naive to say that we do, but we won't stop.
And then in the United States, aboard Air Force One, US President Donald Trump has faced rather pointed questions about the arrest.
Do you think people in this country at some point, associates of Jeffrey Epstein, will wind up in handcuffs too?
Well, you know, I'm the expert in a way because I've been totally exonerated. That's very nice. I can actually speak about it very nicely. I think it's a shame. I think it's very sad. I think it's so bad for the royal family. It's a very, very sad. To me, it's a very sad thing. When I see that, it's a very sad thing. See it and to see what's going on with his brother, who's obviously coming to our country very soon, and he's a fantastic man, the king. So I think it's a very sad thing.
Now, Donald Trump has not been exonerated in this scandal. He is named multiple times in the Epstein documents, but being named in the files does not imply any wrongdoing. There's been reaction back home as well. Government frontbencher Mark Butler telling Channel 7 that the law must follow its course. And he's also described it as a fall from grace.
I think all of our thoughts as human beings, not members of government or the opposition, but all of our thoughts as human beings go to the girls and the women who are caught up in this hideous network of powerful men that Jeffrey Epstein pulled together, and we're starting to see some accountability.
Well, Ian Dunt is a familiar voice on Radio National. You'll know him well if you listen to Late Night Live. He's a columnist for the iPaper, and he explained the sense of shock that Britons are feeling today.
It's pretty, I'd say it's pretty full on, to be honest. It's odd. It sort of created this strange kind of moment of optimism around those people. The natural response is to say, well, look, isn't this a dark day for Britain? Isn't this a dark day for the royal family? You know, the brother of the king is being led away in handcuffs. But actually, there's this sort of oddly optimistic sense to it, of thinking like, well, people do talk about equality and the rule of law quite often is one of the things you're supposed to be proud of in this country. And there's probably no better demonstration of that than what took place today. So people have it's obviously a moment of crisis for the royal family. People actually have quite a strangely upbeat assessment of what happened today and a sense of satisfaction about it as well.
That's interesting. Has that surprised you?
I suppose the thing is that, look, we've had, I mean, God, you know, we've been looking at the Epstein story for basically two decades now, and certainly for the last 5 years, we've been looking at it quite intensely. And it sort of opens up this world that's quite hidden away, which is about power and money and sexual abuse. Every sector, every different country has their own variant on this scandal. And it sort of gave the impression of very powerful people just get away with it. They don't care. Even in their emails, even after they've been arrested, you know, for something to do with underage girls, they just boast about it. They laugh about it. They're untouchable. They go, they work as trade envoys, but they're basically just carrying out their own private business initiatives on the side. Well, what happened today was like, well, no, actually, you know what? There is a limit to that stuff. You can be touched. You are touchable. You are vulnerable towards police investigations and towards parliamentary pressure and public pressure as well.
What did you think of the statement from Buckingham Palace on behalf of the King?
It's cautious. And it has to be cautious. I mean, you read it, by the time that this stuff starts, you really do have to be quite careful. And you'll see the same if you read any kind of journalistic copy at the moment. Just not to, you know, commit contempt of court. People have to be very careful about the way that they're talking about things in order not to prejudice a trial. So that seems fine. However, I think it comes on the back of a pretty reluctant series of media operations from the palace. You know, the questions that are being asked of them, for instance, by the BBC at the moment, they're quite elementary. They're things like, can you tell us details about who went into and went out of palaces? They're obviously looking at certain emails from Jeffrey Epstein saying, I'm going to dinner in, you know, Buckingham Palace. Maybe unrelated emails, but at similar times saying, well, look, can I bring these people along? So you think, well, fine. Do you have a log here? What's your participation? When there was a civil case, in order to wrap things up and say out of court, we're going to have a settlement with one of the women involved, was there any kind of participation from the current king or from other members of the royal family, conversations with Andrew, which might have played into those kind of decisions? That's all being kept well away. And that kind of reticence, that stubbornness about revealing information, that's quite damaging. And the tone of today's statement had the same kind of tenor to it as the previous tones, where they'd shown that reticence.
How much pressure is there on the government in the UK to address a number of aspects of the Epstein scandal?
A huge amount of pressure. Not so many days ago, the Prime Minister lost his chief of staff over his appointment of Peter Mandelson, who also appears in the Epstein emails. As UK ambassador to the US, the director of communications, he is gone. The cabinet secretary, the most senior civil servant, not connected to this story really, but just this triggering of a state of resignations that made the prime minister think, you know what, we'll just clear everything out. And the prime minister's career itself, his time as prime minister, is hanging by a thread, given the amount of anger, particularly on the Labour benches in Parliament, over his needless involvement in this story. And that's on someone who didn't even visit an island. You know, there's no mention of Keir Starmer in any of the Epstein interviews, but just by virtue of having appointed someone who was connected to it, there's that degree of anger. So there's huge pressure. There's now parliamentary inquiries being spoken about Andrew's time as trade envoys. And there's a huge amount of press attention. I mean, we're talking, this is basically on the front page of pretty much every newspaper, pretty much every day. So, yeah, as far as pressure goes, I'd say that, you know, they're coming out at sort of 8 or 9 out of 10 at the moment.
And that is British political columnist Ian Dunt there, sharing just how shocking this news is for those over in the UK. Well, let's move on to other things and a conflict that many believe isn't covered widely enough by the world's press, the ongoing war in Sudan. A UN-backed investigative panel has just delivered a really significant assessment of the conflict. It says the atrocities committed by the paramilitary rapid support forces have the hallmarks of genocide. This is the closest the United Nations has come to declaring genocide in the current conflict in Darfur. Investigators weren't actually able to visit the city of Al-Fasher, but they conducted hundreds of interviews with survivors and they used video evidence and satellite imagery. In the city of Port Sudan, Sheldon Yet is UNICEF's representative in Sudan. He joined Sally Sara and he explained just what these findings mean.
And I think it's very significant. I mean, the atrocities that we heard about in the report are just blood-curdling.
And so it's been difficult for UN investigators to get into some of these areas where alleged atrocities took place in October last year. But there's been thousands of interviews conducted with survivors, and there's also been the use of video, photography and satellite imagery as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's sufficient proof to indicate that extremely bad things happened on the ground there. UNICEF does not determine whether or not something is an event was genocide, but what is obvious is that thousands of children, thousands of women, thousands of people lost their lives, were deprived of their basic rights, and really we saw a bloodbath there.
What's the situation like now, Sheldon, for aid workers and members of the UN trying to get in to provide assistance to people in Darfur and those who've been displaced from Darfur?
Of course, the city of Al-Fashir has fallen. Many of those people who are in Al-Fashir have fled to surrounding communities. They fled to other parts of the country. It's still a very insecure part of the country. There are drone attacks regularly there. People on the move constantly. We all have to negotiate step by step, mile by mile, to get access, to get our supplies where they need to go. We need to deal and negotiate with multiple armed forces. So it remains a very steep uphill battle.
How concerning is the situation for children at the moment when it comes to food, health, security, education, and other aspects for them?
I am extremely concerned. Half the children in this country are in desperate need of humanitarian support. There isn't a corner of Sudan that doesn't need help. Of course, the Darfurs and the Kordofans, which are now the front lines of the fighting, are areas where the most acute needs are. But they are children, they are communities, they are families everywhere in this country who need support. And this is a country of people on the move. Thousands of people are on the move every day, going from one community to the next, being taken in by host communities, being provided with support by those communities, and only a fraction of the humanitarian aid that is required is actually reaching these communities because of the difficulties of access and because of the limited funding.
How much added terror is there from the use of drones? Because this is a new aspect to the conflict in Sudan, which has been going on, particularly in Darfur, on and off over the past couple of decades.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, drones have been part of this conflict from day one. But the amount and sophistication of drone attacks keeps increasing. And as you know, towns and communities have been looted, people are going to other forms of warfare, the drone warfare, just using the shock and the horror on communities. And we continue to see schools being hit, hospitals being hit, IDP sites, sites where internally displaced people are seeking shelter being hit. We just had an attack just a couple of days ago that left up to 15 children dead. So the horror mounts by the day.
Is there enough international attention on what's happening right now in Sudan, in your view?
No, not at all. There's plenty of attention on disgraced princes issues of governance throughout the Western world. There is almost no attention on what's happening in Sudan. I've been here now for some 2 years. I've been doing this kind of work for some 30 years. And I have never seen a conflict as massive as this, as broad as this, affecting as many millions of people as this one is, which is essentially invisible to the world's public.
That is UNICEF's representative in Sudan, Sheldon Yett. A really difficult place to end today's breakfast wrap. I know, but as you just heard from Sheldon, this is a story not talked enough about by the world's media. It's important that we cover it. That is today's episode for the breakfast wrap. It is our last for the week. Thank you very much for sticking with us through a really big week of news and interviews by Sally Sarah, and always produced by our crack team at Radio National Breakfast. Michael Commode helped craft today's breakfast wrap episode, and as always, Eleni Soltis is our executive producer. I'm Luke Sydenham-Dundon. Take care this weekend. We'll see you Monday.